All right, we had our break. If we do this part this week, next week, there are others who are going to be here, as I understand, and it'll be even more profitable, or it'll be right in something they'll be very interested in. The subject will be education. Remember, Sister White said about Jeremiah 36, she said, this is a record of historical events that will be repeated. Let all who desire to receive warning read carefully. And they, God's chosen servants, she said that in 4 Bible Commentary 1159, and then in 4 Testimony 180, she said, they, God's chosen servants, must expect to meet just such opposition as was manifested by the burning of the roll that was written by the dictation of God. Those are something we have to keep it in mind. Now, in Life Sketches, on page 196, it talks about history, and it has one sentence there that I think is very important, and this is what we're going to look at. We're going to look at early Adventist history, and we're going to look at the cover-up of the death of James White. But on Life Sketches 196, it says, we have nothing to fear for the future except as we shall forget the way the Lord has led us and is teaching in our past history. So there is a value to learning and studying the past history because it applies to the future, to our own future. If we study how James White was treated, he and Ellen White, we can see then how the faithful will be treated even now and in the future in the same manner. And then in Great Controversy, page 10 and 11, and that's Roman number 10 and 11, it's the introduction to the book Great Controversy, written by Ellen White, so it is inspired. You ever read the introduction? It's inspired. She writes this: the same hatred of the principles of God's law, the same policy of deception by which error is made to appear as truth, by which human laws are substituted for the law of God, and men are led to worship the creature rather than the Creator, may be traced in all the history of the past. Satan's efforts to misrepresent the character of God, to cause men to cherish a false conception of the Creator, and thus to regard him with fear and hate rather than with love, his endeavors to set aside the divine law, leading the people to think themselves free from its requirements, and his persecution of those who dare to resist his deceptions, have been steadfastly pursued in all ages. They may be traced in the history of the patriarchs, the prophets and apostles, of martyrs and reformers. In the great final conflict, Satan will employ the same policy, manifest the same spirit, and work for the same end as in all preceding ages. Very important. So we study the preceding ages of our church and look at the reformers that worked in our church closely to Ellen White and her writings and see how they were persecuted, because it is his persecution of those who dare to resist his deceptions have been steadfastly pursued in all ages. And we can learn something from that persecution on what we can expect. If you will, let's see, would you pass those out? I know you haven't got those, I think. This is a summary that you're getting of the life of James and Ellen White when we get through with this. You all have one of these now. The Ellen G. White and James White fact sheet. I didn't write out the whole quotes, but I have them all listed there so you can look them up. It's very important if you get a chronological idea of their life, especially the last 10 years or so of their life, and then you look at how James White was martyred, you'll understand more about why and how he was martyred if you look through this fact sheet that draws out the events of his life that lead to the martyrdom. In 1843, and just going through it, in 1843, of September, Ellen White was disfellowshipped from the Methodist Church. You can read about it in Life Sketches 43 through 47 and Two Spiritual Gifts 21 through 23 and One Testimony 35 through 38. She experienced disfellowshipping herself concerning truth. In 1846, on August 30th, Ellen White and James White are married. Life Sketches 97, Two Spiritual Gifts 83, and One Testimony 75. In the autumn of 1846, if you'll read One Testimony, page 75, you'll find out that Sabbath observance was begun by James and Ellen White. They had no houses of worship in which to hold meetings, so most meetings were held in private homes. One Testimony, page 75. Notice, they began worshiping on Sabbath in the autumn of 1846. The mistake would be then to go back to the summer or the spring of 1846 and say, well, since they weren't keeping Sabbath, we don't have to either. Yet that's the mentality of many people who are false shepherds today in the church. They go back to the earliest statements of Ellen White, and they never look at the broad scope of the same subject throughout her writings. And that's what we have to do. It's a common trick of false shepherds in the Laodicean movement today. It's a common trick to go back to an earlier statement and ignore later statements. And so you have to learn to check dates. I'll give you an example. The conference false shepherd, and they're not all false shepherds, but some of them are, and surely the ones that do this are false. They'll go back to a quote that Sister White gave in 1875, and they will ignore some 15 quotes that she gave after that time. This is the quote they go back to that comes from 1875. I'm just giving a sidelight here on the importance of looking at dates. They quote this quote, comes from Third Testimonies, page 492. I know you've all heard it. Quote, I have been shown that no man's judgment should be surrendered to the judgment of any one man. But when the judgment of the General Conference, which is the highest authority that God has on earth, is exercised, private independence and private judgment must not be maintained but be surrendered, end quote. They go back to that quote in 1875. Have you ever heard that before? Where they tell you have to yield your judgment to the General Conference? They go back to that 1875 quote. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's in your church manual. Okay. They go back to that quote. I'm just going to give you a couple. If you want a whole study on that, I'll give you a printed study that shows what they do ignore. That comes in 1875, that quote, and they'll go back to 1875. But they don't quote this quote that's found in Unpublished Testimonies, page 35, on the same subject, but it comes in the year 1896. So which is more valid? An 1875 quote that says we should yield our judgment to the General Conference, or an 1896 quote? Which one would be more valid to you? The later quote, right? And listen what she says in 1896, and they'll never tell you this. She says, well, first of all, on page 34 of Unpublished Testimonies, she tells the General Conference that she doesn't want them to assume control of the publishing work. Have they done that today? Yes, they have. The General Conference has control of the Review and Herald and the Pacific Press. Unpublished Testimonies, page 34, she's against that. Then she starts out on page 35 and she says, in this step there has been a change of responsibility, but the wrong principles remain unchanged. The same work that has been done in the past will be carried forward under the guise of the General Conference Association. The sacred character of this association is fast disappearing. What will then be respected as pure, holy, and undefiled? Will there be any voice that God's people can regard as a voice they can respect? There certainly is nothing now that bears the divine credentials. 1896. Does that make a difference then to go back to 1875? Quote, to go back to an 1875 quote and say, I have been shown no man's judgment should be surrendered to the judgment of any one man, but when the judgment of the General Conference, which is the highest authority that God has on earth, is exercised, private independence and private judgment must not be be maintained, but be surrendered, 1875. And in 1896, she says, there is certainly nothing now that bears the divine credentials. And she's talking about the General Conference. Just what? 21 years later. So which quote are we going to go to? We're going to go to them all. Put all of them in chronological order and see the picture. But surely it's a being a false shepherd to go back to the earlier quotes that have been entirely changed by later comments she's made. She goes on and says there, the enslaved, unpublished testimonies, page 35, 1896, the enslaving of souls of men by their fellow men is deepening the darkness which already envelops them. Who can now feel sure they are safe in respecting the voice of the General Conference Association? If the people in our churches understood the management of the men who walk in the lights of the spark of light of the spark of their own kindling, would they respect their decisions? I answered no, not for a moment. 1896. Does that make a difference then when people go back to 1875? That's misusing the concept of authority and surrendering your judgment if you go back to 1875. And of course, then they ignore 1901. 1896, she said this. 4 years, 5 years later, in 1901, she said this. She is found in the General Conference Bulletin, page 25, column 2, paragraph 1. And she said that these men, and she means the General Conference, that these men should stand in a sacred place to be the voice of God to the people, as we once believed the General Conference to be, that is past. And she never took that back. That's past. And she called for a reorganization, didn't she? Now, I'm going to want to get into the 1901 reorganization. We could study that. I would challenge you to look in testimonies to ministers because they claim that she that they reorganized just as she said, Roman number page 13, They say they reorganized in 1901, just like she said. But then you go ahead on your own and read 8 Testimony 90 through 106. See what she says in there. Because she says they did not do as she said in reorganization. Anyway, the purpose of what I just wanted to say and to let you know there, to keep in mind when you run into something like this, check the dates. And that's what we're doing. We're going to put these dates of James and Ellen White's in chronological order and take a look at them. Notice then in autumn 1846, they begin keeping the Sabbath. So you see, it wouldn't be valid to go back to 1845 and quote Ellen White on a subject of Sabbath and Sunday and say, okay, we can keep Sunday. It's just as wrong to do that as it is to go back to 1875 and try to get people to give up their judgment and yield it to the General Conference when later statements tell us we shouldn't be doing that. As a matter of fact, they won't read this one either. Seven Testimony 107, done in 1902. Now another year later, after 1901. She writes this in 7T107, page 2. Let them, meaning our people, let them be afraid of heeding the counsel of any man, whatever his position may be, who works counter to that which God has wrought in order to keep his people separate from the world. Ah, that's a pretty good statement, isn't it? In light of yielding your conscience to the GC. It's conditional, isn't it? They make it an unconditional statement by quoting one quote. But here she said, let them, meaning our people, be afraid of heeding the counsel of any man. Does that include the GC president, the conference president, the local preacher, the deacon, any elder, anybody?
me, you, anybody. It says, let them be afraid of heeding the counsel of any man, whatever his position may be, who works counter to that which God has wrought in order to keep his people separate from the world. See?
Now, if we go and show people are being brought closer to the world by people claiming to be shepherds today, then we shouldn't have to follow their judgment, right? That's the idea. Okay, then, continuing on in 1847 through 48, in the winter, James White chopped wood at 50 cents a day. That gives you some idea. Have you ever chopped wood for a couple hours with an axe? Whew. It really gets you tired quick. Chop wood all day long for 50 cents a day. Once you get an idea, and he was doing this so he could make a living and so he could do the Lord's work and pay for papers and supplies and things like that. Life Sketches, page 105, Two Spiritual Gifts, 88, One Testimonies, 82. In the same time frame, during the winter of 47 through 48, Ellen White had only 9 cents left to buy milk for 3 mornings in those days. Two Spiritual Gifts, 89, One Testimony, 83. Then in 1848, during June through July, James White mowed grass at 87.5 cents per acre. Did you ever try to mow grass by hand? 87.5 cents an acre? Not a tractor. No air-conditioned stereo tractor enclosed. That no self-propelled business. You're the one that's propelling. Yeah, Life Sketches 109 through 110, Two Spiritual Gifts 94, 96, One Testimony 84 through 86, and Three Testimony 318. Then during the summer of the next year, 1849, James White struggled to publish Present Truth, a little paper at Middletown, Connecticut. This work was affected by a lack of means. There were those who had means that were Adventists, but they chose to keep it. Now just think, he struggled to publish these books and these articles, and they're out of print today. Look what he went through to struggle to publish them. And Adventists let them go out of print today. Can you imagine letting a prophet's writings go out of print? And what's the excuse that's given? Nobody wants to buy them. Is the solution then to let them go out of print? Or is the solution to get people to realize what they're missing? But the false shepherds today raise the price so that people are discouraged to buy them and then let them go out of print. That's not solving the problem. And we should be aware of this to realize which spirit is influencing here. When we see a prophet's writings going out of print, I don't care who people are that are claiming they're working on God's side. If they're letting God's writings go out of print, they're not on God's side. Look at the struggle that was gone through to get those things in print. Now, read about it in Life Sketches 125 through 126, Two Spiritual Gifts 116, and One Testimony, page 87. Then in 3 years later, in 1852, Ellen White and James White lived in a house rented for $175 a year. Life Sketches 142, somebody said, I'd like that. Life Sketches 142 and Two Spiritual Gifts 160 and One Testimony, page 190. As we go through here, keep in mind whether you would like to have that experience that they're both having as we get through. Because if you follow her today in Israel, you'll have her experience. And you're going to see what it was all about. What they did to her and her husband, they'll do to you if you follow her. In 1855, 3 years later now, in 1855, the Office of Publication was moved to Battle Creek from Middletown, Connecticut, from the east. It was moved from the east to Battle Creek. James White owed between $2,000 and $3,000 in publishing expenses. Orders for publications were few and small. James White feared he would die in debt. Ellen White writes of James White being brought to an untimely grave because of overwork. One Testimony is page 97. Keep in mind, there were Adventists that had means, but they chose to keep it. They wouldn't help him. And he's going in debt, publishing these materials that are out of print today. Does that bother you somehow? It bothers me. Now, then in December of 1855, James White's salary was $4.09 a week. Just think, in 1855, he was $2,000 to $3,000 in debt, publishing materials that we so carelessly allow to go out of print, and he's only making $4.09 a week. And he's living on that. That gives you some idea of how valuable he considered publishing these works, doesn't it? You read about it in Two Spiritual Gifts, page 205. In June of 1860, Ellen White and James White were watched with jealousy and suspicion by those who were claiming to be Seventh-day Adventists. Leaders, top leaders. James White was unjustly viewed as being too hard and severe. Ellen White and James White feel no union with the church at Battle Creek generally and spent Sabbaths at home. Ah, they don't talk about that much, do they, when they tell you you've got to be in the church building, you're not going to church today, do they? James and Ellen White in 1860, in June of the year, in Battle Creek, where the head of the General Conference was at, were persecuted so much that they didn't even worship there. They stayed at home. How about that? Read about it. Ellen G. White Pamphlets in the Concordance, Volume 1, page 231. Oh, they went back. They kept going back, but there were times when they'd stay at home because they just could not worship there. In August of 1865, James White, worn with the labors of writing, publishing, and bearing heavy responsibilities in Battle Creek, is stricken with partial paralysis. James White suffered a physical and mental breakdown. Ellen G. White was cut off from active labor for 15 months because of James White's illness. Now look what led up to his illness. He paid a heavy price up to 1865 so far for getting us writings today that people let go out of print. Read about it, Third Testimonies, page 17 through 18, Life Sketches, 167 through 172, One Testimony, 103 through 104, Two Selected Message, page 306. See, I wanted to pull together some of these testimonies and put them in chronological order, because if you read the books, you don't get the chronological order of these compilations. I wanted to put them in chronological order so that you get the flow of what they were going through. In December of 1866, a year later, James White had been incapacitated 15 months since August of 1865, about a year away, and Ellen White stood alone with the influence of the church, of the professed church, including those at the head of the work at Battle Creek, against her. Top leadership of the General Conference was against her in December 1866. Read all about it. Ellen White and James White began a three-month working tour in northern Michigan. Sister White was so concerned about the failing of the health of James White and his health that she felt that to get him away from Battle Creek and the influence of the false brethren there, he would help to restore him to his healthy position. He'd been incapacitated for 15 months. And so she took him on a speaking tour, a working tour in northern Michigan. They went for 3 months. They left Battle Creek to try to get his health restored. Life Sketches 168 through 174, One Testimony 103 through 104, 570 through 572, and 582. Then in January 1867, while they're on the road in Michigan doing the work, they receive discouraging letters from Battle Creek. Imagine they won't even leave them alone when they go out on the road. One Testimonies, page 576 through 577. Let me read a little of that. She says on 576, while thus laboring and speaking and writing, I received letters of a discouraging character from Battle Creek. As I read them, I felt an inexpressible depression of spirits, amounting to agony of mind, which seemed for a short period to palsy my vital energies. For 3 nights I scarcely slept at all. My thoughts were troubled and perplexed. I concealed my feelings as well as I could from my husband and the sympathizing family with whom we were. None knew my labor or burden of mind as united with the family in the morning and evening devotion. And she goes on. They were still after them, even though she was on the road and her husband were on the road for 3 months. Then, in the same year, a few months later, in 1867, after 18 months of illness, James White's mind and body are restored. Ellen White has a dream. Now, you've heard about this dream, but I want you to get it in the time frame of what it came in. It was at this time now where Ellen White has a dream that's found in 1 Testimony 577 through 579. Ellen White has a dream that she's in Battle Creek, seeing a company march up to her house. She knew them well, but before she opened the door to receive them, the scene was changed. The company took on the appearance of a Catholic procession, she said. One bore in his hand a cross, another a reed. The one carrying the reed made a circle around the house, saying 3 times, "This house is proscribed. The goods must be confiscated. They have spoken against our holy order." Oh, there's a lot in that dream. Do you see when it came now, during the time period it came in, and the persecution she was getting from the brethren at Battle Creek? And notice, if you read about the dream in 1 Testimony 577, she was in Battle Creek and she saw a company coming up to the house. She looked out the side glass door, and how did she describe them at first? She said, "I knew them well." She said, "I knew them well." Who are they? They're the brethren in Battle Creek. I knew them well. Then before she opened the door, she looked again in her dream, and the scene was changed. The company now took on the appearance of a Catholic procession, keeping in mind she knew them well. And how did she describe a Catholic procession? One bore in his hand a cross and another a reed. To her, cross images were symbols of Catholic processions. Read Testimonies to Ministers, page 67, paragraph 1. She calls the cross an ignominious cross. The image is what she's referring to. The image, ignominious, means something despicable, something to be despised, something shameful. The cross image is a cruel instrument of death and torture. It's the symbol of Tammuz, son of the sun god, in Babylonian worship. We are to exalt the act done on the cross, but not the image. And something happening with the sound here. Oh, TM page 67. Let me read that to you, and then we'll go on. I just wanted you to see the time frame of when that quote came in concerning the Catholic procession. I think it means a little more when you get it in context with her life experience. Testimonies to Ministers, page 67. I'm going to read a little bit here, and then I'm going to ask you which one, when she says cross, is she referring to the image or the act? I'm going to ask you. She says, "Their Savior had been rejected and condemned and nailed to the ignominious cross. The Jewish priests and rulers had declared in scorn, 'He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he be the King of Israel, let him come now down from the cross, and we will believe him.' But that cross, that instrument of shame and torture, brought hope and salvation to the world." Okay? Now, when we read the word cross, you'll read in other places in the writings of Ellen White, she says the highest point that man can attain is the foot of the cross. Is she talking about the image of the cross or the act done on the cross of self-denial? The highest point that man can attain, is it the image? No, it's the act. Yet today, in the Laodicean church, it's the image that's being exalted, and the act of self-denial is being ridiculed, mocked at, and sneered at. That's what's being done by those who wish to follow Christ in self-denial in many areas. Diet, dress reform, worship practices, prayer, life insurance, voting, you name it. Now,
when she says their Savior had been rejected and condemned and nailed to the ignominious cross, which one is she talking about there? The image or the act? The image. He's nailed to the ignominious cross. That means ignominious means something despicable.
This is the testimony of Jesus, isn't it? And Jesus writes that instrument he died on is ignominious. Then does it make any sense for us to come along and put it on the front of our pulpit? Or put it on a flag? How ridiculous. How ridiculous. We reject Constantine's Sunday law, but yet Constantine had the vision at Melvian Bridge when he was praying to his sun god. You can look it up in the Adventist Bible commentaries and read about it. He was praying to his sun god and he saw a vision. Well, who did he get that vision from? Satan. And the vision he saw a cross in the sky. And these words, in hoc signo vincens, in this sign conquer. And he took that sign, that cross image, and put it on his flag and called it the Christian flag. We got them hanging in our churches today. They come from Constantine, son of worshiping the sun god. And God himself, Jesus, who died on that abominable thing, as he calls it in Ezekiel chapter 8, he calls it an abomination. It's the symbol of Tammuz. He declares it to be ignominious. Now, people today think it's not ignominious, something despicable. They're going to have a problem when they get to the judgment. Then it goes on and it says, but that cross, that instrument of shame and torture, okay, which one is it talking about there? The instrument of shame and torture, the image or the act? The image. That cross, that instrument of shame and torture, brought hope and salvation to the world. What brought hope and salvation to the world? The image or the act? The act. But you see how they can get confused? People get them confused. When we read the word cross, we have to keep in mind, is it talking about the image or the act? Let's exalt the image, or the act. But let's keep in mind the image is Catholic, particularly Catholic. Even Great Controversy says it. I don't want to get on this too much. Great Controversy, we have other studies on this. It says, papists place crosses upon their churches, upon their altars, and upon their garments. Everywhere is seen the insignia of the cross. Is that talking about the image or the act? The image. And that's Great Controversy, page 568. And you notice who does it? Who places them everywhere? Papists place crosses upon their churches, upon their altars, and upon their garments. Everywhere is seen the insignia of the cross. Everywhere it is outwardly honored and exalted. But the teachings of Christ are buried beneath a mass of senseless traditions, false interpretations, and rigorous exactions. Sounds a lot like Laodicea today. Incidentally, you know the word papist? You know how Webster's defines papist? She said here, papists place crosses upon their churches. You know how Webster's defines the word papist? Look it up sometime. It says it's a hostile term for Roman Catholic. What's being expressed there? What is her feeling about the cross image there then, when she uses the term papist? And keep in mind, who's inspiring her? And if you were hung on that thing, wouldn't you be a little hostile to it? And yet we go put it on our pulpits. Oh, whoa, is that strange, isn't it? Strange mind. We put it on our pulpits because we love him. If we really loved him, we wouldn't put it up there. It's so disgusting. I walked into Catholic churches. I've been in Catholic churches not too long ago. Walked in, and they had a life-size replica of Christ, flesh-colored, red blood, everything, hanging on a life-size cross. And when I walked in, I caught it out of the corner of my eye, and I turned and looked. It just took my breath away. And everybody in there is running around talking about how their car running and their dress and what the kid did mowing the lawn and, you know, and we're going to have donuts and rolls before service or after service. And there's the Son of God, so lifelike, it still takes your breath away. Completely indifferent to it. And that's the purpose of Satan, brothers and sisters, to get our eyes to focus upon a dead Christ on a crucifix. when we're to focus on a living Christ after the resurrection. He wants us to look at the dead Christ and the death instrument and exalt it. And he's doing it. People are being deceived and they're doing it. They're exalting the instrument and lowering the act in their lives and criticizing others who want to follow those acts of self-denial in their lives. You can read more in Volume 2, Review and Herald, page 231, Column 2, Paragraph 4. That's Review and Herald, July 24, 1888. Sister White said, quote, "Jesus died for you on the cruel cross of Calvary." Is that the image or the act? Jesus died for you on the cruel. Now, who's saying that it's cruel? Jesus says it's cruel. Then men today are saying there's nothing wrong with it. Uh-huh. They want to follow Christ? They call themselves Christian? It's not Christian. It's Tammuz. It's the order of Tammuz. That's where the cross comes from. That's where the T comes from. Son of the Sun God. That's where it comes from. It's taken from the first letter of his name. Son of Satan. You go around today and you see all these rock stars with crosses on their things. They literally belong to the synagogue of Satan. Some of them literally to the visible church of Satan. What are they doing wearing a cross? Black Sabbath and nonsense groups like that wearing crosses. You go to one of the largest occult libraries in the world, right here in Chicago, the Loyola University, Catholic University. You go there and go downstairs, they have one of the largest occult libraries in the world. Look up a book on witchcraft. I'm not recommending this, but if you did, open up the book and you'll find out that many witchcraft ceremonies, occult ceremonies and spells and incantations are done with cross images. That's why God describes them in Ezekiel chapter 8 as an abomination of Tammuz that drive him far from his sanctuary. If you were hung on one for 6 hours and suffered and died the most cruel of all deaths, would you want to come to a church that was exalting the image? Whew! How blind can people get when God calls it cruel and ignominious? You can also look in early writings on page 245, and God, through the spirit of prophecy, calls it cruel there also, the cruel cross. And that's a reference to an image, not an action. Let's always, brothers and sisters, no matter how much it costs us, like with Ellen White, let's exalt the act of self-denial and speak against that pagan, godless image that Christ detests. You'd detest it too if you hung on it for 6 hours. And I want to be his friend. And if he hates it, I want to hate it. If he loves something, I want to love it. And if I can't understand why he loves or hates something, I want to ask him. And he'll show you. And that's a proper balance, by the way. A love of righteousness and a hatred of iniquity. Love righteousness and hate iniquity. That was the balance that Christ had. Hebrews 1:9 says it right there. And that was why he was commended of the Father. That was the proper balance. Today, false shepherds are misunderstanding how many times you try to tell them some of the things you've heard even today. And they'll probably say to you, you're unbalanced. Have you ever heard that? You're unbalanced. Try to hold forth truth that's not popular. You're unbalanced. Ask them, what is balance? What is your definition of balance? Hebrews 1:9 gives us the definition. It's a love of righteousness and a hatred of iniquity. That's balance. Now, what's the problem? How do you become unbalanced? You stop hating iniquity and you just claim to love righteousness. Unbalanced. And what's another way? You stop loving righteousness and you just hate iniquity. That's another way. You become unbalanced. Then there's another way. What if you love righteousness and love iniquity? Oh, that's unbalanced, isn't it? An only proper balance is a love of righteousness and a hatred of iniquity. And if we can't do that, if we can't understand when God says something is an abomination, then we should ask him why. Show me why. Give me the heart that you have. Give me the humbleness of mind that I might understand why you love this and why you hate that. Do you think God loves Sunday or Sabbath? Didn't he give us a love of righteousness and a hatred of iniquity on that? And what about baptism by immersion and sprinkling? Didn't he straighten that out? And diet and dress and on and on and on. And then we come to the cross image and we fall down flat. The very thing that tortured him to death, we exalt. People are so deceived by it today, they think it'll protect them by wearing it around their neck. They think that somehow it's a talisman. You read in Great Controversy, during the Lisbon earthquake, look it up. Satan had done by then, by introducing the cross image into Christianity. During the Lisbon earthquake, mothers ran around and sought out their cross images during the earthquake. They neglected their babies and infants during the earthquake and ran after their cross images, crying, "Misericordia, misericordia, the world is coming to an end." And they died. Talk about slavery to an image. That's where Adventism is heading, brothers and sisters. And yet I've had leaders tell me today, it's not so, it's not so. But you go speak against these images in churches and you watch. You watch the fangs and the claws come out. The people are reverencing this image. And you look in the Roman Catholic Encyclopedia, look up the word cross. You look up some of their plans. You know what their plan is for the Protestant world? To reintroduce pictures of Christ and the cross and ultimately crucifixes and get people to reverence them and ultimately worship them. That is their stated plan, to reintroduce those images into Christian world. And yet you read about the life of Pharaoh in Great Controversy during the Dark Ages. He succeeded in getting them to remove the images from Morat and Nucatel. You can read about it in Great Controversy, page 232. It says they accepted the Reformed faith in Morat and Nucatel, and they removed the pagan images from their churches. That would include the cross image. It would also include images of Jesus. I don't want to go into images anymore. That's a whole other topic. But I wanted you to see here what happened, what Ellen White was encountering here in the church, in the called church. She was fighting the order of Tammuz, brothers and sisters. They were the order of Tammuz. They weren't Adventists. They were walking around, thought they were Adventists too. They weren't. You notice what she saw in her dream? They drew a circle around her house and said, "This house is prescribed. The goods must be confiscated. They have spoken against our holy order." What holy order? It's not the holy order of God. It's the holy order of Satan that's being referred to. Read about it, Two Selected Message, 306, 308, and One Testimony, 577 through 579. In the same year then, after these things are happening to her, in March of 1867, during the same time, Ellen White and James White were distressed beyond expression, receiving a cold reception at Battle Creek, where they met distrust, suspicion, and reports having no foundation in truth. You want to hold forth the writings of Ellen White? What do you think you're going to meet today? I mean, if that's what the prophet met, what do you think we're going to meet when we just read the prophet in Israel today? When that was during a time frame that was leading up to an apostasy which was called the Alpha of apostasy, and we're living in the Omega of apostasy now, what do you think you're going to meet? Which was worse, the Alpha or the Omega? Remember in her writings in Series B? In 1904, she said in Series B, number 2, page 16, "Be not deceived. Many will depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils." That doesn't mean you have to leave the geographical location of the church. The high priest in the first coming of Christ, they had departed from the faith, but they were still preaching in the synagogue. Be not deceived. Many will depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils. We have now before us the Alpha of this danger, and the Omega will be of a most startling nature. The Alpha was in 1904. We're living in the Omega. She said in 1904, the Omega is just before us. We're living in the Omega now. A more startling apostasy. The Alpha of apostasy was caused when Kellogg rejected the spirit of prophecy. He rejected Ellen White. Ellen White told him not to print the book Living Temple. And what did he do? He printed the book Living Temple. And what was he at the time? He was in charge of the Department of Medical Work for the General Conference. He was the top medical worker recognized by the General Conference. So what's the cause and effect of the Alpha of apostasy? It's one top leader rejecting the prophet and doing the opposite of what the prophet wanted. And what was the effect? He printed the book Living Temple. Now then, what's the Omega? What's the cause? The cause is a rejection of the prophet by many leaders. That's what's most startling, see? It's not just one man like Kellogg. It's across the board, and it's not just on one subject. It's on many subjects. Worldwide rejection, leadership rejection of the spirit of prophecy. That's the cause. That's the cause. What's the effect? False worship practices, false education, false medical practices. You see, today the conference is saying that Walter Ray and Desmond Ford are the Omega of apostasy. They say they're the cause. Brothers and sisters, Walter Ray and Desmond Ford are the effects. They're the effects of the apostasy, not the cause. They grew up in a system that was apostate. It caused them to be where they're at today. They're the effects, not the cause. They grew up in worship practices and in school practices that were paganized. They're not to be blamed for the Omega of apostasy. They're just the effect. We're misunderstanding the cause and effect. It's the same thing as if we looked at Living Temple during the Alpha of apostasy, and we say, see, the Living Temple book is the cause of the apostasy. No, it's the effect. The cause was a rejection of Ellen White. Read about it in Series B, number 7. Read the whole letter. Kellogg rejected Ellen White and did the opposite of what she wanted him to do. Read Series B, number 2 and number 7, specifically 2 and 7 on that, if you want to read more on that episode. And you know, when you read Series B, you'll notice one thing. When he rejected her, let's see if I can find it. When he rejected her, they claimed to believe in the spirit of prophecy. Here we go. Series B, number 7, page 60. She says this in 1905. I have not been able to sleep during the past night. Letters have come to me with statements made by men who claim to have asked Dr. Kellogg if he believes the testimonies that Sister White bears. He declares he does, but he does not. End quote. That's another characteristic of the Alpha of apostasy. Top leaders declared they believed in the spirit of prophecy, but the prophet said he does not. See? Now that was startling. That was startling during the Alpha, but she said, remember, the Omega would be of a most startling nature. And what's the Omega? Worldwide behavior of leadership in the same way of Kellogg, only more of them now. Many, 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 many more. That's why it's so startling. On many, many subjects. And yet they claim to believe in the spirit of prophecy, but present it to them and watch what they do. They claim to believe it, but they do not. Let's go on. In 18... Okay, in 1867, they received a cold reception at Battle Creek, where they were met with distrust, suspicion, and reports have no foundation in truth. They had been absent from Battle Creek for 3 months on the road in Michigan, trying to get James White healed, trying to get James White recovered from his breakdowns. In spring, you read about it, Life Sketches 175, One Testimonies 579. Then in the spring of 1867, false suspicions and false reports were circulated against Ellen White and James White in Battle Creek by the brethren. Life Sketches 177, One Testimonies 573, 580 through 584, 605, Three Testimonies 311 through 316. I know from personal experience they do this today. They issue false reports about you, although they even know they're false, and they keep on with it. I would give you examples, but I don't want to get into other topics. I know from personal life experience they've done it to me. They'll do it to you. They'll do it to all of us. We're living not in the alpha of apostasy. We're living in the omega, which is much worse, much deeper, and we don't have a living prophet. We have our writings. You see the situation we're in? How much more so we need the writings and we need our connection with the Lord? And men are not having connection with the Lord. They're having connection with other local men and pastors and leaders. That's the problem. In 1867, in the spring, poverty caused Ellen White and James White to sell their furniture in Battle Creek. The brethren in Battle Creek did nothing to relieve Ellen White and James White's poverty and misused this deep affliction to accuse James White of being insane on the subject of money. When they were on the road during those 3 months in their work, they were asked, "Do you need some money?" And they said, "No, we don't need any money. Not now, but if we do need some, we'll let you know." Then when they were back in Battle Creek and they really did have a need for the money, they asked for the money and they were rejected. And they were accused of being insane on the subject of money. They were so poor they had to sell their furniture in their house. Remember what she said about the need for us to remember history? If we forget the history, the way the Lord has led us in the past, what will we be in danger of doing in the future? Falling in the same mistakes, right? They tried to sell their home in Battle Creek also in that spring of 1867. One Testimony, page 595. In the spring of 1867 then, Ellen White and James White built a home in Greenville, Michigan to leave Battle Creek. One Testimony, 592 through 593, 595 through 596, 599, 605, and 675. You know the height of ignorance today, brothers and sisters? When people say, "Yes, all this is true about Battle Creek, but we're in Washington now." Do you change the spirit if you take it from Battle Creek to Washington? Is the spirit changed just because you move a location? If the organization is not following Christ and is not the same, does it matter whether it's in Washington or Battle Creek? In May of 1867, accusations were still circulated against Ellen White and James White at Battle Creek. They were accused of being extravagant. Extravagant? Do they sound very extravagant from reading their life? Oh, I can tell you. I've had accusations. I can know what it's like. So will you. So have you, many of you. Do you know what they were being accused of being extravagant about? Let me read you a little bit of that. One Testimonies 593 through 595. When we came to Battle Creek, page 593, One Testimony, we found that our previous efforts had not accomplished what we had hoped. Reports and jealousy still existed. My soul was filled with intense anguish, and I wept aloud for some hours, unable to restrain my grief. In conversation, a friend with whom I had been acquainted for 22 years related to me reports which he had heard that we were extravagant in expending means. I inquired wherein we had been extravagant. He mentioned the purchase of an expensive chair. I then related the circumstances. My husband was greatly emaciated. You know, look what he'd been through, physical and mental breakdown. My husband was greatly emaciated, and it was exceedingly wearisome and even painful for him to sit long in a common rocking chair. And for this reason, he would lie down upon the bed or lounge a great chair of the time. I knew that this was no way for him to obtain strength and begged him to sit up more, but the chair was an objection. On my way east to attend the bedside of my dying father, I left my husband at Brookfield, New York, and while at Utica, looked for a spring sofa seat chair. The dealers had none, but at the price which dealers had none made at the price which I wished to pay, which was about $15. But they offered me a very excellent chair with rollers instead of rockers, priced $30. Priced at $30 for $17. See, it was a $30 chair and they offered it to her for $17. She was willing to pay $15. So it was getting, but she was getting quality goods for $2 more. And she goes on, I knew that this was the chair, this was the chair in every respect, but the brother with me urged me to wait to have a chair made which would cost only $3 less. The chair offered for $17 possessed the real value in itself, but I yielded to the judgment of another, waiting to see the cheaper chair put together, paid for it myself, and had it carried to my husband. The report concerning our extravagance in purchasing this chair I met in Wisconsin and Ohio. See, she didn't even buy it. She bought the cheaper chair and they still circulated the fact she was extravagant. Now, the report concerning our extravagance in purchasing this chair I met in Wisconsin and Iowa. But who can condemn me? Had I the same to do it over again, I would do as I did, with this exception. I would rely upon my own judgment and purchase a chair costing a few dollars more and worth double the one I got. Satan sometimes so influences minds as to destroy all feelings of mercy or compassion. See what she was going through? They accused her of being extravagant over a chair she didn't even purchase, but she wished. She said if she'd have had it to do it again, she would have anyway, even though they were accusing her. Not a small thing. She had to meet this accusation in Wisconsin and Iowa. Are those quite a ways apart? The accusations that were going around about him being extravagant? In August of 1867, Ellen White and James White were urged to return to Battle Creek. One Testimonies 677. And they were overburdened with care at this time. One Testimonies 676. In October of 1867, James White called a council. Now we'll read this in detail. Read these six pages sometime that I have listed there. In October of 1867, what was his health? He was recovering. He was not doing that well, was he? He had recovered from his mental and physical breakdown, but you have one of those things you need to be careful, don't you? And what was it going on then? He'd recovered in March of 1867, and in October of 1867, now what is that? March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October. 7 months after his recovery of a 15-month mental and physical breakdown duration period, 7 months later, in October 1867, James White called a council at Battle Creek himself to investigate charges against him and his integrity. James White himself, in October 1867, asked for a church trial to clear his name. Read about it. One Testimony 606 through 612. October 23, 1879, Ellen White states this. Those who ought to be humiliating their souls before God will then begin to justify themselves. And she quotes the brethren at Battle Creek now, and she says this, "What an easy, happy time we were having. The church was in a pleasant condition." This is what the Battle Creek people were saying. "What an easy, happy time we were having. The church was in a pleasant condition. We were doing well. But lo, here come Elder White and his wife, the disturbers of Israel. They always create a trouble whenever they come. If they only had the sweet spirit of Elder Smith, he never hurts anyone's feelings. He never says sharp and cutting things." That's where she stops the quote that Battle Creek was saying. And then she continues with her own words. And she says, "But these blind ones do not see that this very pleasing, careless indifference on the part of men at Battle Creek, who have failed to keep the fort, has created the necessity for the alarm to be sounded and the cutting rebukes to be given. Where would the church drift were it not for the plain, close-searching testimonies to arouse them from their slumber?" End quote. This is Ellen G. White, Pamphlets in the Concordance, Volume 1, page 481. You can read it there if you want, pass it through, and people will look at it with their own eyeball. Notice what she was saying. What was the church at Battle Creek calling her? Her and James White. Do you see the time flow and how it was affecting them? Now what were they calling them by 1879? "But lo, here come Elder White and his wife." What are they now? Disturbers of Israel. And then what did they say? They always create trouble whenever they come. Have you ever been told because you want to hold forth the writings of Ellen White or the Word of God in Israel that you're a troublemaker? That wherever you go, you create trouble? If you read too much Ellen White, then you're told you're a troublemaker. Don't feel bad. Draw warmth from the coldness of others. They said the same thing to her. But I wanted you to see the flow of time and where this happened in her life and the circumstances preceding it and following it. Then in July 1881, now we're getting into the meat. Now we have the testimonies that are being written that have been tampered with today. And I want to go through the testimonies with you in the order they were written. The order they were written. July 1881, she wrote extracts from previous testimonies. And this was read before the leading members of Battle Creek Church, reproving them of the spirit they had and the bitterness that they had manifested against James White in July 1881. Less than a month before her husband died, she read this testimony, extracts from previous testimony, and she rebuked the brethren about the way they were treating her husband in July 1881. And brothers and sisters, August 6, 1881, he died. Now, what did they do with that testimony today? Well, we'll take a look at what they did with it. They changed the date, changed the title, dropped the footnote, took out everything that applies to James White and put it in Fifth Testimonies. Take a look at that. August 6, 1881, James White died at Battle Creek. You can read about these events in Ellen G. White Pamphlets and Concordance, Volume 3, page 512, Life Sketches 252, 269, One Selected Message 104 through 105, 2SM 259, 267 through 269, One Testimonies 105 through 112, and Five Testimonies 67. She made this statement in Two Spiritual Gifts 197, quote, "My husband dies a martyr to the cause of present truth, and who realizes what he has suffered?" This is what is she saying? When she says, who realizes what he has suffered? What is the testimony of Jesus saying there? Is it urging us to know what he has suffered? It is, isn't it? Isn't that Jesus' will that we learn what he has suffered? Why would we have to learn that? Why would we have to know that? To know the direction from the persecution, where it came from, that that resulted in his martyrdom? Wouldn't that be valuable? You suppose then we could see the same thing happening to us today? The same direction? Yes. Yes. In August of 1881, after James White's death, Ellen White suffered a severe attack of malarial fever and the shock of her husband's death. Life Sketches 256. Then in December 1881, she wrote the testimony called Our College, which you'll find in Fifth Testimonies 21 through 36. But you should compare this with Ellen G. White pamphlets in the Concordance, Volume 3, page 474 through 482, the original. Today's 1948 Fifth Testimony 21 through 36 edition has numerous deletions, as well as does extracts from previous testimonies that was written July 1881 of that year. Then in March 28, 1882, the testimony entitled Important Testimony, Fifth Testimony 45 through 62, is to be compared with the original, which is found in Ellen G. White Pamphlets in the Concordance, Volume 3, page 42 through 43. Again, Fifth Testimonies 45 through 62 has numerous deletions. In June 20, 1882, she wrote the testimony and called Testimony Rejected. That's the way you'll read it in Fifth Testimonies 62 through 84. I'm sorry, the testimony is called The Testimony Rejected. You'll find this in Fifth Testimonies 62 through 84, but it's not called Rejected there. The title is changed and it's called Slighted. They changed it somewhere along the line. Is there a difference between slighted and rejected? Of course there is. You should compare this testimony slighted with testimony rejected. They're identical except for there's deletions taken out of the Fifth Testimonies edition of 62 through 8, page 84. Compare this with Ellen G. White Pamphlets in the Concordance, Volume 3, pages 493 through 505. She also wrote in that year, 1882, June of that year, she wrote Workers in Our College, testimony there. Fifth Testimonies 84 through 94 is where it's found. But compare that with Ellen G. White Pamphlets in the Concordance, the original, Volume 3, page 505 through 512. In Fifth Testimonies 62 through 84 and 84 through 94, there are numerous deletions. Therefore, 4 Bible Commentary 1159 and 4 Testimony 180, both commenting on Jeremiah 36, have fulfillment in the above deletions or penknife changes as predicted because God has restored them today. Here's those manuscripts in their original form. Everybody can have a copy. If you don't have one, you got another one. If you do have one, they come from Ellen G. White Pamphlets in the Concordance. You can look in there and read pages 473 through 514, and that's exactly what you have in your hand now. It's a Xerox copy of this original testimony. This original testimony corresponds with various parts of Fifth Testimony today. Now, let's see here. Can we take a break right at this point and just get a drink just a minute? Because there's a few things I'd like to put together while you're on break. I noticed from being out here on the road, I have to put a few things together to show you some overheads. Should we kneel for prayer? The strength that I can get in looking at this is that when I see Sister White and James White persecuted for holding forth the truth, and then I personally go around and share with the brethren the same words from the writings of Ellen White, and you get persecuted, I don't feel as if it cut as deep. Because if they're going to do that to the prophet and her husband, what are they going to do to you? It doesn't have as much of an effect then. And the more times I go through it, the more I become aware and try to identify and I meditate on what their experiences were, the more of a strengthening coat I have, and it seems as if some of the barbs that the enemy throws at you can't get through anymore. the more you look at it and see the way they treated James and Ellen White, and it starts coming at you the same way, you just kind of smile and say, oh, I've been waiting for this. To be expected, you see. Now, the manuscript that you have in your hand comes from the Ellen G. White Pamphlets in the Concordance, Volume 3, pages 473 through 514. That's where it comes from. We're going to take a look over this week and the next week at extracts from previous testimonies, which is called Jealousy and Fault Finding Condemned in the original. In the 1948 edition, I'm sorry, in the 1882 edition, it's called Extracts from Previous Testimonies. In the 1948 edition, they changed the title and they call it Jealousy and Fault Finding Condemned. That's the way it reads in Fifth Testimony. We're going to look at that today, and we're going to look at the testimonies rejected today concerning the cover-up of James White's death. The order that the testimonies were written in cannot be discerned from looking in the table of contents of the fifth testimonies. Here's the table of contents of the fifth testimonies as it's currently published. That's this, you know, this book. That's just the table of contents of Volume 5, Fifth Testimony, 1948 edition. Notice copyright 1948. How clear is this? Could it be clearer? You say when, because my eyes are the problem. Okay. I'm wearing 20-year-old glasses, remember. My other glasses broke. Copyright 1948 by the Ellen G. White Publications. Now, the first testimony that was written there is listed as Jealousy and Fault Finding Condemned, but it really should be entitled Extracts from Previous Testimonies. When you compare the two, they're identical except for some omissions. The second testimony in the order of sequence they're written is Our College. The next one is Important Testimony. The next one is Testimonies Rejected Should Be Not Slighted, as it's currently stated in the contents of Fifth Testimonies. And then fifth is Workers in Our College. You have these five testimonies there in the original form. And what you do is you take a look at the current edition of Fifth Testimonies and compare it to the original. In the original manuscript you have, you'll notice the pages in the original manuscript are different than the pages in Fifth Testimonies. In the upper corner of the page, I would write in the appropriate page number. For example, if you'll turn to your manuscript, page 80. It's way in the back. It's the last one. Now, this was written first in year of sequence, in order of sequence. Extracts from Previous Testimonies was written July 1881. Okay? And it was, although it was written in July 1881, it's listed in the current index. Well, let me show you. Well, let's do this first. Notice Extracts from Previous Testimonies, original manuscript, page 80. Everybody there? This corresponds with Fifth Testimonies 94 through 95. You should see my handwriting with a little slash over there to show you the corresponding. You should be able to distinguish between the original manuscript page and my handwriting that shows you the corresponding Fifth Testimony page, right? That should make it easier for you to do your comparisons. Now, what's changed is what I have circled. It's been changed or it's been dropped out altogether and deleted. Here's the page you're looking at. Notice the title says Extracts from Previous Testimonies, and then we begin reading. It pains me to say I have been shown that there are unruly tongues among the church members at Battle Creek. Okay, these circled things have been taken out. This is no big, real big change here, but I want you to see that it's the same testimony with some changes. This is Fifth Testimonies, page 94, which corresponds. The title's been changed from extracts to previous testimonies. The title's changed to jealousy and fault-finding condemned. Can you see it? And it says, it pains me to say, and there's a break, that there are unruly tongues among church members, and there's a break. You see, it's the same testimony. There's the original. It pains me to say I have been shown that there are unruly tongues among the church members at Battle Creek. And here's the current edition. It pains me to say, there's a break. See, they left out this. That there are unruly tongues among church members, and they put a period, and they left out at Battle Creek. You see? Now, that's just to get you on target that we're talking about the same testimony. No problem so far. No problem, right? Now, take a look a little further down and look at this. Yes. All right. Right. The words I have shown, I wish I could talk to you about 80 hours down the road. In comparison to what else they've done, this is a drop in the bucket. But every one of these changes is significant. The thing is that all of her writings, none of her writings are her opinion. That's the thing. No matter what it looks like, every one of her writings are inspired. But to add the words, I have been shown, adds emphasis to them.
Right.
Right.
And I feel that
there
should remain in there.
I feel that it all should remain in there.
Yeah.
Every jot and tittle should be in there. Now, let's see as we go on. What I wanted you to see was extracts from previous testimonies, the original, is the same thing as Fifth Testimonies, page 94, Jealousy and Fault-Finding Condemned. They changed the title and did some changes. Okay, now, notice then a little further down in the original manuscript on page 80, it says, Satan exalts, you follow me? Satan exalts over the condition of God's professed people. While they are neglecting their own souls, many eagerly watch for an opportunity to criticize and condemn one to whom God has entrusted responsibilities in his work. Now, this one that she's talking about is James White. The circled portions have been taken out of the current editions. I want you to see that it's James White by looking at extracts from previous testimonies. The title, see the asterisk